This is Global Media News and all the WWR, all the West by Web Radio. I am Eric Uppich.
And I'm Eric Andrew. This week from the New Media Newsroom.
From the New Media Marketing Desk.
Are marketers using conspiracy video to promote brands?
On the social marketing beat.
Just how popular are child influencers on Instagram and Facebook?
From our podcasting report.
Will Luminary be a podcasting game changer?
From the scary meme list.
Is Momo coming from our children?
On the digital music beat.
Are digital metronomes and click tracks a recipe for cookie cutter music?
From the New Media and Sports Desk.
How is online sports gambling disrupting sports media?
All this and more coming up on OWWR, the Westbury Report, streaming live from the University of New York, College of the Westbury.
Let's get started with a report from Emily Zumbach, our YouTube expert. Emily, this week you are here to discuss how the popularity of conspiracy theories, especially conspiracy videos on platforms like YouTube, is having an effect on the advertising and marketing world. Are marketers really trying to tap into the viral popularity of conspiracy-themed content on social media? Tell us what first drew your attention to a brand that is using conspiracy content for marketing.
Shane Dawson, who's a famous, like, an ultra-famous YouTuber, he has multi-million followers. He did a conspiracy video on Chuck E. Cheese pizza, and he said that the pizza, he claimed that there was a conspiracy that Chuck E. Cheese was recycling their pizza. Now, he had this whole video about how it was a conspiracy and all of these things that were happening that we aren't realizing, and in turn, Chuck E. Cheese gained a lot of momentum from this conspiracy theory. You know, a lot of people that would normally be eating at Chuck E. Cheese started eating at Chuck E. Cheese. So they gained a lot of money and revenue from this viral video because he has over 15 million subscribers. So that's 15 million people that said, hey, I want to go to Chuck E. Cheese, buy a pizza, and test out this theory.
So that kind of just shows just how much power YouTube has when it's all these things to really influence people. Like, so how are these conspiracy videos being used to sell products?
So what's happening now is companies are taking these viral videos because conspiracy theories, they go viral. Like, it doesn't matter what the conspiracy is about. As soon as you put conspiracy theory in your title, automatically people want to test the theory. They're going to watch your video. They're going to look up other videos relating to that theory. And some companies are capitalizing on that. They're saying, hey, listen, like, you're using our name, our products in your video, so they in turn take that video and incorporate it into their marketing.
Does it start with the company going to the YouTuber, or is it the YouTuber wanting to gain attraction by using conspiracy, having that, like, the slogan to bring in viewers, and then the company in turn will come to them and say, listen, we're going to try to exploit that?
I think originally it was just people coming up with these crazy conspiracies. I think now the companies are behind some of the conspiracy videos because they say, hey, let's start a fake conspiracy video about one of our products and then it'll become a viral video and then we can use that to our advantage.
Right.
So I think now that it's becoming more popular, it's becoming more artificial, if that makes sense.
Right, absolutely. And do you think video creators are aware they might be simply promoting a product?
So even though it's happened like a couple times now where a conspiracy theory video has caused a product or something to go viral, I think even Shane Dawson in making this video, his thought process wasn't, oh, people are going to go and buy Chuck E. Cheese pizza. I think he truly was just trying to make this conspiracy video, not realizing what was going to happen. One big example that I found was the Denver International Airport. There are so many conspiracy theories about that airport. The airport itself decided to take their marketing strategy and put up posters of the online conspiracy theories in the airport itself, which I thought was so crazy. But they said that it was a way for people to incorporate the online world with real life, and it drew people to the airport because they want to now figure out, are the conspiracies true? And the airport's kind of playing games with their guests and saying, like, do you think it's true?
Right, exactly.
Letting them kind of figure it out themselves.
I think this situation is kind of polarizing because I'm sure there's some people who feel like they shouldn't really take advantage of that. Like, for me personally, I think, you know, if you're going to take a brand and a company and you're going to try to exploit it by using or making up some sort of rumor about them or a conspiracy theory, they should have every right to exploit it and try to get money off it since they didn't get permission to actually use their company's name. Like, what do you think about that? Like, do you think they have a right to do that?
In that sense, when you say it's a conspiracy theory, you know, you have to say this is not true, this is not fact. And and it's just an idea that you had that you want to see if someone else had the same idea too, it becomes more of a legal issue if you're claiming that these conspiracy theories are true. And it's very funny, if you watch this one Shane Dawson video, he emphasizes this is not fact, this is not true, this is open for question. I am not, this, none of this is real, this is just me with a conspiracy theory. If the company decides, hey, you know, you used our name in your video, why not capitalize on that? I mean, they have every right to do that. So in that aspect, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
If their name is being mentioned, they have every right to make money from it.
I think so too. And like, do you think, like, how is the consumer really affected by this type of marketing, you think?
So I think it comes down to, the consumer doesn't want to be lied to, because there are people who believe some of these conspiracy theories and miss the whole point of this is not true. They just see the conspiracy theory itself. So if that portion of it is missed by the viewer or the consumer, they're believing something that's untrue about a product or a brand.
Right, it's false advertising.
Yes,
and I think it's important for every YouTuber who decides to do conspiracy videos to have that sort of disclaimer.
Oh, absolutely.
Or, like, do you have to have it, like, maybe, like, underneath the video?
So that's the thing. There's no rule on where it has to be, how many times you have to say it. Me, personally, I think you should say it beginning, middle, and end, and also say it in your description. This is
absolutely
true.
Yeah.
Put it in your thumbnail. It causes the video to become less popular if the people know for a fact it's just a conspiracy theory and it's not true. What makes it go viral is that thought of, could it be real? So that's why some creators say, I'm not going to disclaim it so much. But in the case of when it comes to just legality and everything, I think they should just say, this is definitely just a conspiracy theory and it's not true.
There are some cases, too, where I kind of wish they have it like almost in the title, because there's
right.
A lot of clickbait when it comes to YouTube, where they'll say one thing and then I'm waiting, I'm watching a 10-minute video. As it doesn't even come up. So it's one of those things, too, where I think the YouTuber has to give the consumer, like, as much information as they possibly can, and I think that's one of the big things about these conspiracy videos.
Absolutely. For Global Media News, I am Emily Zubek. Back to you, Eric Richter.
Thank you very much. We have more social media marketing news for you. Alita Blue is on the influencer marketing beat for us today with a report about the increase in kid influencer marketing. Child influencers are a big business for brands. Alita, why are marketers interested in using child influencers, and what are the positive or negative consequences of turning children into marketing channels?
Thank you, Eric. Well, it's not a surprise about how much influence social media has on online shoppers. When certain companies promote their brand, they make sure they have someone that can help improve the image of the brand. So when companies like Walmart and Staples want to promote kid-related items like toys, clothes, school supplies, and other things like that, they look for children with a big enough audience to help advertise it. Companies usually make large endorsement deals with families of children with a lot of followers, or children who have verified accounts. And even though the children are the face of the account, it's primarily run by the parents. It usually starts with the parents having a lot of followers and deciding to explore the option of giving their child their own fan base to create a bigger fan base as a family. Posts that are most popular are more authentic posts, like kids playing at the park, baking cookies, just having fun in general. Brands like to build off those moments to gain attention and make a profit.
So, can you explain to us, like, so how are the children being affected by being on social media?
Well, people can understand that it can be difficult for anyone's child to be in the public eye, especially on social media nowadays. But a professor emerita named Catherine Montgomery at American University School of Communications made a statement to the New York Times saying that it can be very manipulative to children. Being exposed to promotion and advertising at a young age can affect the way they view life later on. But on the other hand, some people feel like it can have a positive effect on children, with a good explanation about what they're doing from the parent and constant communication with everybody involved. I even came across a New York Times article mentioning a 10-year-old child influencer named Princeton Cannon, who talks about understanding the work needed to keep his Instagram popular. His account was created and ran by his mother, and he has even taken an interest in being in the public eye and aspires to be a model or YouTuber.
Yeah, it's a very polarizing topic, because when you have social media, there's so many positive and negative influences, and for children especially, you kind of want to, I'm sure there's a lot of debate about whether this is, like, ethically right or not. What will the families do when their kids grow up?
Some parents of child influencers don't really have a plan when their child gets older. As mentioned earlier, Princeton, the 10-year-old child influencer, wants to pursue YouTube when he's older, and he's even mentioned it to his mother that he decided that he wants to keep his Instagram open just in case, like, he would like to manage it himself when he's older. But many parents who, like, get asked this question usually come up with a statement where the moment their kid interest wanes, the cameras will turn off, basically, like, giving the child his best interest. If they're no longer comfortable, then they'll shut the cameras off and continue on with their day. The child will continue what their parents, like, basically, sometimes the child will continue what their parents started or start fresh with an idea of their own. It won't be long before a new set of stars are created and decide to use the spotlight in their favor. But I have a question for you guys. If you had the opportunity, and if you were a parent and had the opportunity for your child to be a social media star, would you take it?
That's tough. I know I'm sort of an old school type guy, so I would really have to see what exactly the purpose of the social media is, like what he's doing, or he or she is doing. I would feel like, you know, if my kid's very passionate, I wouldn't feel right as a parent to sort of deter him, he or she, from that path.
I was going to say, if you would have asked me this question a couple years ago, I would have said absolutely yes. But lately, YouTube has been kicking back on some of the children, the kids that are in certain videos, they've been disabling comments on them.
Yeah.
There's been these inappropriate comments under the videos, and there was also something said, I forget who said it, someone stated that technically you're putting this person, your child, on YouTube in a video without their consent, and technically that is wrong. And if they grow up in the spotlight, they may, yes, want to just continue it because they're so used to it. But initially, they're not in the place. You can't give an infant the option of, do you want to be on camera or not? So you're making that choice for them.
Basically, they're still not old enough to make consent.
And even though they're babies, like, if something happens on camera, you know, not that anything that would happen to a toddler can affect them in the future, but you just never know. You never know. You just never know. And so it's a weird line to cross.
And cyberbullying is, like, pretty traumatic. So that's one of my concerns. But again, like, bullying is going to be around no matter what, cyber or real. So it's sort of like,
it's like how you raise your kid to, like, understand that that's part of it. Continue it, or is it something that you would take a step back?
And being exposed to it at an earlier age could have some benefits of being able to handle that in the future. Like, there's going to be bullying throughout your whole life, so. But again, like, with you, it's your own kid and the person, it's hard for me to really just say 100% yes, but it really depends on the situation.
It's also super eye-opening when I heard that these pedophiles are looking up these videos of the children playing in a park.
Yeah, there'll be videos of a kid playing with just a regular toy, an unboxing video, and they'll just...
And I couldn't believe these articles that I was reading about this. I couldn't believe that these... And I'm talking thousands of these people are online with these accounts watching these videos that we claim are innocent. Is a child playing in a park innocent? Absolutely. But what the result is, the people who are watching these videos should not be watching these videos. And unfortunately, YouTube is an open platform where anyone can be watching these videos. So again, it's your choice. Do you want your child to be in a position where anyone can view your child's videos?
Yeah, definitely. Thank you guys for your feedback for the media and this kind of way to go back to your audience.
Thank you very much, Nidhi. Yeah, that's a really polarizing topic again. We'll be right back with podcasting news and a report from our scary meme desk. Will the Momo challenge really kill your children? Or is this another viral media focus?
Podcasting industry is growing in China. There's a lot of coverage on podcasting and business page right now. Investors are paying attention. Everyone's trying to figure out which would be the most profitable business model for podcasting platforms. Should podcasting follow the Netflix model? Will it be a subscription-based streaming service, or will this be about selling podcast listeners to their platforms? Will the big streaming platforms like Spotify swallow up to podcasting in addition to dominating the music business? Podcasting has become the latest growth sector of the new media industry. Big corporations are taking an interest in new media podcasting startups and snapped up, merged, and acquired by the giants of new media market. Eric, you're here to tell us about a one player in this industry, this podcasting competition that's making news. It's called Luminary. What is Luminary? How did it attract your attention out of all the recent news about podcasting?
Thanks, Eric. Yeah, so for for me, I'm always looking for new platforms. Like, I'm a big streamer, and I think everyone is really. And for me, podcasting has really become one of my big passions. Like, I'm actually starting my own podcast, called the Stephen King Podcast, and my friend and I are going to be recording. But what's fun about podcasting is you get a lot of different topics, you get a lot of different voices, as opposed to just the mundane radio. So for me, when I found Luminary, it's interesting because Matt Sachs, the co-founder, he said, his actual quote was, "We want to become synonymous with podcasting in the same way Netflix has become synonymous with streaming." So yes, it's going to be very much like a Netflix-type platform. And what's really good about that is, you know, it's allowing for a lot of different things to happen in terms of having a nice organized and a nice outlet for only podcasting. So, you know, Apple and Spotify have become the giants for music streaming in all over the world. And they actually noticed how popular podcasting has become. Spotify, within the last year, has spent over $340 million in podcasting. So that's a clear indicator, especially if one of those giants, to say, listen, we understand that this is a market that's constantly growing, and we want to be a major factor into that.
Awesome. Yeah, I didn't know Spotify had that many podcasts on their app.
It's really going great, crazy now, yeah.
Okay, it's cool. I'll check it out. So what do you think of the advantages of having a premium streaming service?
Well, when you think about, like, let's do it comparatively to Netflix. So with Netflix, when it originally came out, it had a lot of movies originally, and then they brought in the TV shows.
And the DVDs.
Yeah, exactly. When the DVDs were a big thing, and no one does that, but what's really interesting to see is the original content, and I think that's what's really key about this whole thing, because when you think about Netflix, you know, you start thinking about shows like Stranger Things and House of Cards, and you know, like all these, they're becoming the platform that, you know, artists want to come to do original content. And that sort of exclusivity is sort of really making strides and having people bring in, having more viewers come in to that platform.
Awesome. It's pretty cool. So you could use Luminary to put podcasts on, or would that be like?
I would definitely consider it, especially now that I think it's becoming one that a lot of the big name artists are going to. You know, for me, it's just to get myself everywhere. But it's Luminary seems to be the one that if you can get, you know, in that platform, that's going to be the whole thing, the real mecca for podcasting. And I think now, like, again, the popularity, like, for me, I listen to Dax Shepard. He is a Gontra expert, and he's an actor I followed for a while. And then all of a sudden, he became sort of, he didn't really do a lot in the show business anymore, so he kind of just decided to do this. And it really, he has a very interesting aspect of talking to actors, not so much about the Hollywood, you know, it's not that easy all the time, the tabloids, but their personal life. So it's almost like a niche that podcasting allows them to do. So I think more and more people are starting to really want to look for that.
Yeah, so perfect. I was thinking about it. Like, you said you were going to start your own podcast.
Yes.
So I've never heard of Luminary before, but I've watched multiple podcasts. Like, Joe Rogan is one of my favorites. So what I noticed about podcasts these days is, like, this is the new age of talk radio. I mean, you hear of, like, Howard Stern and all these huge talk radio guys, but now they have their own podcasts, and especially with Joe Rogan, I think there's aspects of, he really touches the world. I mean, when you say Joe Rogan, I feel like everybody knows who he is, what he does, how he has a podcast, and how I think it really touches the world is, I don't know if you've seen that one with Elon Musk.
Yeah, that was a big one.
Yes.
It had,
like, I believe, like, 250 million views.
Yeah.
And that's a lot for a podcast. You know, a podcast that's an hour and a half.
And he's a comedian. He's a comedian, and he's talking about things that isn't just, you know, humor-based. Like, he's talking about everything.
I've seen ones with him, Neil deGrasse Tyson, you know, the astrophysicist. I love him.
That's really cool.
The one I want to go back to with Elon Musk was, it affected our economy in a way, because he, when, I believe he, like, took a, he smoked weed, right?
Yeah, he had a dog on the set.
Yeah, on the set, and his Tesla stock dropped like 20 points the next day.
And he sold out of it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, truthfully, it just shows the power of a small podcast that's in a room, you know, 10 by 10, just talking and really just speaking the truth about what they do and about how they feel. And I think it's almost like they're so too exposed. Like, they don't have time to just say, oh, I don't know if I can talk about this or not, or I don't know if I can do this. It's just so natural with the podcast because it's like a conversation.
Absolutely. It's so easy for a startup to even begin doing that because, like, even for me, like, I'm always looking for my competition, but like, I even looked up Stephen King podcasts that are out there, and I mean, they got, like, no real viewership, so, but they're on Spotify. Like, you have a chance to get on, and you can really, you know, it brings in so many different topics, and there's sort of that focused niche of it where if you're looking for something specific, you're going to be able to find it. Like, when you go on if it's the radio stations, you're going to get, like, a broad stroke type of thing. I don't listen to how to start, of course, but, like, again, it's sort of like you're looking for, like, just, like, a billion sports podcasting, where you have, like, Barstool, you have, like, a different, even, like, big networks have their own podcasting, but, again, it's this growing industry, and I think Luminary really decided, like, listen, we're not going to just, you know, have a billion, we're going to have a foot in so many different avenues, we're not going to have music, we're not going to have TV, we're just going to have podcasting, and I think, especially now, they're really going to really be a very popular platform, because everyone's looking for that podcasting.
That's pretty cool. So just one last question, Eric. Like, how would you go, if someone wanted to start a podcast, like, how would you go about putting it on Luminary versus, like, first, the ease of putting it on iTunes, Spotify, just go onto a website and just put your audio on.
You know, I wouldn't even, if you want to do this, then I wouldn't recommend just pigeonholing yourself to one thing. I think for, you know, a lot of people start out with, SoundCloud's huge, even YouTube. Like, I know I'm actually considering doing the YouTube route because, you know, there's a lot of so many viewers, and then you can make it into, like, it's not going to be a video, but you can have it, the sound clip, and have a picture, maybe, like, one of us give you a picture on there, and have that run for, like, and the thing that's great, too, is, like, podcasts run for hours. Like, it's not, like, you can do a 2-hour podcast, and, you know, a lot of people say, well, it's a little too long, but, like, I have a long commute, you know, I get to listen to my whole podcast with Dax Shepard all the way home, so it's actually really great, and all of that, even the exclusivity, like, I'm already talking, like, Guy Raz, and some of the podcasts are already signed up to specifically have his own show called How I Built This. Lena Dunham, Trevor Noah, has already signed up to Luminary. So Luminary is really drawing in these creative outlets, and then people are going to be like, oh, well, I'll listen to Lena Dunham one, and someone on Luminary, so I'm going to let me sign up to Luminary. And I think having that subscription base, like, Spotify can't put all its eggs into one basket with podcasting because it's a huge music platform. So having Luminary just for podcasting, they're really going to, you know, calm down and really focus on all the kinks and stuff. So I think Luminary is going to be a huge success.
That's really good.
Yeah, I think it's going to be really good. So for Global Media News, I'm Eric Landro. Back to you, Eric.
Thanks, Eric. Tasha Smith, one of my classmates, is following me for us. It's a challenge we call Momo Challenge. Tasha, what's the Momo Challenge? What did you hear about this first?
Actually, I heard it on Instagram, and I was hearing about this Momo person coming in telling kids to commit suicide, and I was like, what is this? And actually, it gained its popularity after an alleged suicide of a 12-year-old girl who was found in her backyard near Buenos Aires, Argentina, after rumored to have had an online conversation with Momo. After supposedly having such a close examination of her phone, the so-called victim was having an alleged back-to-back conversation with an 18-year-old girl whom she may have met up with from social media. According to News Australia, they believe the teenager's intention was to upload the video to social media as part of a challenge crediting the Momo game for the suicide. Other people have claimed that interaction with Momo included being sent violent images during the night and the unknown person threatening to appear while they are sleeping and curse them.
That is pretty intense. But I don't know if I want to just take a game and feel the need if someone's telling, if someone's telling you that, like, if you see, like, some videos online, with they call the phone, they use, like, WhatsApp, I believe, and they call the phone, and they keep calling, and they just keep pressing until, like,
that is pretty scary, actually.
It's really scary.
I saw it online, like, I think I was scrolling through, like, Facebook or something, or something.
Actual, like, Momo picture. I think it's just, like, a Japanese art sculpture of, like, Mother Bird.
My PS among Asala is the thing that's called Mother Bird. And it's gorgeous.
I saw it online, but I didn't really read it.
It's really creepy.
Because now, like, you see things online, you're just like, oh, I don't know if this is, like, is it even worth clicking? Because if it's not real, I just wasted a minute.
The actual picture sculpture is really creepy.
Yeah, I saw the picture, and I was
just like, oh, it's like, there's, like, these weird colors around it. And then they started to move the eyes around, so it looks even more intimidating, more scary. So what other, Taisha, what other challenges have there been that went viral?
There's the ice bucket challenge, where people would take water and put ice on it and, like, pour it on top of you.
Yeah.
For the AOS challenge, and then there's the cinnamon challenge, where you eat cinnamon and you try not to breathe it in too hard, or you start suffocating.
Yeah, it's a choke.
Yeah.
How did I know about it?
I did it. I did it before. I almost died. I was like, nothing but cinnamon was pouring out of my mouth. It was hilarious. Almost died.
Thing is, like, I love cinnamon, so I didn't think anything was going to be bad. And then, like, there's a bunch of cinnamon, and it went right out of my nose.
Like, yeah.
It's all the way up. It's horrible.
I did the ice bucket challenge. I think that was like 2 or 3 years ago now.
Mm-hmm.
That was a long time ago. And I really warm. Yeah, for sure. You're right, maybe 4 or 5. But I remember I did it. I will never forget this. So I was at a friend's house, and it was the winter. Like, I don't know if you remember, it was during the winter, and, like, we're in New York. So it's like 20 degrees outside already. So then I'm outside, and I get an ice fucking dumped on me. I think I almost had hypothermia. I was like a minute away from getting hypothermia. But, I mean, you know, I support ALS, so I had to do it. And I was nominated.
But I said it was like a good cause. Like, the cinnamon challenge was just stupidity.
I think that's what has to do with, like, Tide Pod challenge. What would make somebody, because they look like gushers or something? Is that, like, a thing?
Yeah.
Is that why they did it?
I mean,
I don't know. So it's kind of mean about it online. I'm saying that, they put it in a bowl of cereal.
Oh, yeah.
So you just see this, these side pots with the bowl of cereal and just the book, and someone's like, oh, you eat it. So then I guess people were like, oh, let's try it.
And then, am I going to defend the people who have tried it? But obviously, they don't look bad. Like, it's like, I've seen it. Oh, all right. Like, there's a guy, no, it's an attractive product. You consume this. But, you know, it does look appetizing anyway. Like, you know, if someone doesn't have all the right space in their head, I guess they want it. But,
just a little question for you, Taisha. Why do you think the Momo Challenge receives so much attention? It's just a hoax.
Start playing with something. If you share something long enough, people will start to believe it. That's how I feel about it. Like, oh, this is being shared. It's getting all these likes, getting all these views, getting all these comments. I'm going to share it so I can tell other people and just spread the awareness.
And then,
yeah.
I think they want it to be real. Like, people want this stuff to be, like, something they can talk about, you know?
They want it to be official.
Yeah.
Like, I totally get that because I think a lot of people, that's the reason why conspiracy videos and all these things come about is because people wouldn't click on it unless they wanted it to be real.
Yeah.
They wanted it to be true. If you saw, you know, aliens came, like, I don't know about you, but, like, I want aliens to be real. Like, I believe in aliens.
There has to be something else out there. We can't, this can't be the aliens.
So it's like, I want these things to be real.
Exactly.
So I think it's more of a what you believe and what you want.
Thank you, Steven, and Eric, and both Erics.
Yes.
Thank you, Erics. Thanks, Tayshia. We're back with digital music news. Our clean tracks making us all march to the same drummer. Does precise digital synchronizing lead to speaking better culture or more creativity? We decide.
Let's keep the beat with my co-host, Eric Unkrich. recent tools and technologies have revolutionized the production of music. The analog days are mostly over for the music industry, except in virtual hipster studios built for producers and engineers who crave those quirky analog acoustics. Some artists are producing their music with just a laptop, no studio required. While digital production has many obvious benefits, some critics are concerned that the digital production process is becoming a bit standardized and sterile. Eric Unkrich is here to discuss on major digital tool of the modern recording studio, the digital metronome. What is a digital metronome? Eric, you have experience in recording studios?
Yes, what a digital metronome is, it's essentially just like a click track. So it's a separate track individual. You can edit, you can adjust the tempo, the tempo, the pitch, the volume to fit the song, so you can hear it better, so it's just going to mix better. But a lot of people use it. Everyone uses it to make everything that needs on time. So, but a lot of, I feel it's really important to bring the adding flow of music to the
world. How do you feel that?
Well, I have an example from TNC, Joe Jonas' new band. It's called Body Moves, and you can just hear the roboticness of it. I really don't use it that much, but
it's so away from the music. You said that was what you're saying.
Yeah, so I'll feel upset. I'll listen to it. Like, it just sounds like.
Yeah, I can kind of see it's more. You don't really listen to like a drum beat or anything. It's more very staccato. Like,
it doesn't sound natural to me.
Yeah,
I think it's more of like. I mean, I used to produce music also. Do you?
I have to listen to the basement, yeah.
Okay, yeah, so like, I'm not sure if you're aware of like Fruity Loops or like FL Studio.
Yeah, FL Studio, yeah.
So, yeah, that's what.
Fruity Loops, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, pretty much like, you could do the same thing, but I think you require more creativity than what you're describing. Like, I've never heard of the program that you're using.
I'm using Logic Pro.
Oh, Logic Pro.
It's like a step up above GarageBand. GarageBand comes straight from Mac.
Yeah,
but Logic Pro is like an extension of fast extension of GarageBand.
Yes. I wasn't aware of it, but I actually used to have Logic. It's the same thing as FL Studio, but it's just the PC version to the Mac version. But I could see why the clip like that you brought in, I really thought that sounded so unnatural. Because when you hear, like, if you listen to a recording of a band, they're actually recording drums in a studio, and obviously they're on beat. Yes, they're doing everything on pitch, but it sounds way more natural. That just sounded like it was made straight off a computer, and him just saying over it. So I can see where you're coming from.
You know, well, full disclosure, I'm pretty sure everyone in this room was talking their head a little bit when that turned on.
So yeah,
can you explain, because I don't really know much about this stuff. Like, is it separate from the program, this metronome? Is this something you have to buy separate, or is it some type of thing that you do?
No, it comes with a lot of Pro Tools. That's more fast metronome click track. So you could have a separate track for it. But a Logic is just like, it's in the program itself. You can't really.
Gotcha.
So it's like, except change the pitch of it, the tonality of it,
something to set up, like I say, it takes away creativity, but it definitely makes things easier, I suppose. That's why people use it. How has the use of the click track affected your personal life?
So when I have a student basically set up for when I record my clients, I set up the drums, do the drums first, and then I re-record the drums to the clients. I'm not gonna edit them on the exact 1, 2, 3, 4, because again, like compared with DSE, it just like sounds too robotic. Of course, if it's not like if it's a beat behind, I'm gonna
exactly
not like go through every. But stop being lazy. I know it's not that hard.
Yeah, exactly.
I know how to do it. When I went to the studio with my band, went to produce with this part Jefferson.
How do you use
DSE? Yeah, we had it. We did the same thing. My buddy Nick Tarantino put us through it, and he did the same thing. He did the drums. And then everything else was more so like natural. Of course, he edited it and just did stuff. But yeah, that's what I think. Absolutely more.
That's great. And so you gave us one example. There are more examples from the top of your head you can think of that use this sort of thing? Yeah, I don't know. Like, I guess, like, is it more like, I guess, like, techno?
It's more like, it's like pop metal.
The CD, no?
Yeah, I was going to say, I feel like I see more in EDM, like, house music and stuff like that, like, club-based music, because it's just,
you know, it's exactly.
Very, if, I don't think there's any other genre of music that's more robotic than that.
Right.
I mean, it's all produced on a computer, unless there's vocals which are recorded, you know, for it, but that's everything, every drum, every snare, every cymbal is literally created.
Yeah.
So that's why I think it would be more.
The song right there sounds like play once. It's called Cutie.
That's a rock.
Right now, because there's an abundance of competition when it comes to the streaming services. So, like your average, like ESPN, Fox News, CSNBC, or whoever covers the games, they're really having a lot of trouble because there's different networks, and most of these fans cannot afford to have a monthly subscription. You're talking 15, almost. Some of them are, I think, like $17 a month, which comes out to almost 20 tax. So, I think people are finding new ways to stream for free online, so therefore I think it's truthfully changing the way sports media is portrayed by us and the fans. But back to the gambling aspect of it, I think it's a lot of streaming sites and even popular ones that we hear of every day, such as ESPN, they created something called ESPN Plus, which is basically strictly based around the viewer, the gambling viewer. So they would have multiple games on at one time, maybe even, I think, close to 30 games at one time. They would just go between. And these people are just sit in a room and, you know, make their bets from their computers for thousands and thousands of dollars and just watch games all day. So I think it's, and they will even report from a gambling aspect, not just from, this is how this player should have done today, or they'll talk, get deep into a play or anything. They're just worried about the score and what's happening during the game.
Yeah, like, you know, with fantasy football, too, like, you know, those type of things, they have specific stats that they go for points. They'll probably only shoot those, like, receptions, yards, like, and that's pretty much what the gambler really, really needs to see. Now, how does sports gambling affect today's youth due to the easy accessibility?
So I think it affects today's youth because kids are, now that they have the accessibility to actually bet, and you're not going to Vegas, you're not going to a casino, so they're not going to check your ID. When I think of youth, I think of, you know, 15, 16, 17-year-olds who are betting on sports, and it could be with their parents' money.
Yeah.
You know, it's not, maybe they'll have a job, but can you really afford to be betting on something that's not even certain, or that you have zero control over? I mean, I can see people who play poker and blackjack and stuff like that, like, yeah, they're making this decision. Oh, I want to hit or stay, or I want to bet or check.
It's somewhere in your control, basically.
Yes, but damn, sports gambling is you're just throwing your money in a pot and seeing the outcome of the game, I think. Because anything can happen in sports. Injuries, if somebody bets on a specific team, like, let's say if they wanted to bet on the Lakers and LeBron is having an off night, you know, he's 0-for-8 from the 3-point line or so, what would happen? You know, you're losing all your money. So,
from a human standpoint, too, like, I bet on sports and I would be praying that someone would get injured just to get out of the game. Like, that's kind of screwed up if you think about it.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I actually did the same thing a few years ago. I took a bet on Real Madrid. I know nothing about soccer.
No.
buddies comes up to me and says, oh, I'm putting some money in tomorrow for the soccer game. Like, would you want to throw? So I put like $15. And I was like, okay, you know, I could afford to lose that. But winning, I would think I would get, the spread was 1-3. So I would almost triple it. And we won.
Man,
I was jumping up and down. I was so happy.
And you're going to your fan now, right? Like, that's the thing that
you have no idea. I'm the biggest. I'm the big. But now, almost a year ago, their best player, Ronaldo, he got removed. And now he's at Juventus. So now I'm not the biggest Real Madrid fan. But I can totally see why I was. Like, I had no interest in it. But it's just because I had a few bucks riding on it. I was glued to the screen.
Oh, it's so addictive. Like, if I was even driving by to just playing with the ball, I'd try to find a way to get in on that. But again, like, it's becoming such an addictive thing. And so for me, like, if you were mentioning, like, you know, you're comparing poker and blackjack and sports gambling and placing table, is it really replacing table games in Vegas?
I think totally, because, you know, I actually recently saw an advertisement for this Showtime documentary. It's called Action. And it hasn't come out yet, but there was almost like a long trailer for like 3 minutes. And it's all about these guys who just live in Vegas, and every day they sports gamble. They sit in front of a screen. They sit in front of a room, and they'll watch hundreds of screens for hours and bet thousands and thousands. Like, these guys are making millions of dollars a year. And in sports gambling, in the United States, almost $5 billion are bet in Vegas every year. And on the black market, with just using bookies, it could be tens of millions of dollars.
That's crazy. All right, Thanksgiving. That's all we got for this week. Thanks to my co-host, Eric Ongrich.
Thanks for listening. With me this week, Eric. Thanks to Chris Smith, our engineer, Castro.
Today, we heard reports from myself, Anita Pelea, Tasha Smith, Steven Spiegel, Eric Ongrich, and Emily Zumbach.
Welcome to this brought to you by OWWR, Old West Bay Web Radio, and the VA Communications Department here at the State University of New York, College of Old West Bay.
For more media news and resources, check out our latest post on globalmedianews.org, where you can listen to all of our webcasts and even subscribe to our podcast feed.
Je ne t'aime plus, mon amour.